Welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm Laura Zara-Papinski. This week, we're getting a behind-the-scenes look at Candlewick Press, a publisher that is constantly putting out kid lit that I just adore. Candlewick executive editor Katie Cunningham is here to highlight standout titles and give insights about her work as an editor that book nerds will love hearing about. Katie Cunningham, welcome to A Bookish Home.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to get to talk with you today. I'm a huge fan of Candlewick. And how this came about was I kept noticing that so many of the books I was loving are being published by Candlewick. And some of the books that I've featured on the podcast, there's an interview coming up soon with the author and illustrator of Alma and How She Got Her Name. I featured House of Dreams, The Life of L.M. Montgomery, and then favorites like Aaron Becker's Journey Trilogy, Kate B. Camillo's books. I mean, the list just goes on and on. So I'm excited to get to talk with you. And for people who aren't familiar, could you just tell us a little bit about Candlewick Press and then also about your role as a senior editor?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for all those kind words. It really means the world to us when people notice that, like, that so many of the books that they're returning to over and over are published by us. We just really love that. Candlewick is an employee-owned and creatively driven publishing house that publishes exclusively for children. And we publish for children from birth all the way through kind of the young adult genre. I hate to put an end number on that because I think, you know, as long as people are interested in reading our books, those are the people who we're publishing for.
Mm-hmm.
So we are one of a kind of triumvirate of companies. We have publishing colleagues in London and in Australia, in addition to an outpost in New York, but we are based in Somerville, Massachusetts.
Great. And I didn't realize until I was looking into it for this podcast that you are employee-owned. Could you talk about that a little bit? Because that seems unique for publishing.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have shares of the company that are dispersed once you've been here for a while, and we have, you know, profit sharing payouts that are paid out. It's really great. I mean, we're all absolutely stakeholders in the company's success in sort of the day-to-day operations of the company, but also, you know, in kind of, if you think of it very literally, like we are stakeholders in the company,
yeah.
which is great.
That's interesting to get a little bit more ownership. And you are a senior editor. Could you tell me about that a little bit, about your role?
Sure. I started here 15 years ago. I was working as Liz Bicknell's assistant. She's our editorial director. And I came to Candlewick right out of college. And it's the kind of career, I don't know how many other careers are like this nowadays, but it's the kind of career where you really learn at your mentor's elbow. And that's definitely how I learned to edit and to find what my particular tastes and strengths and areas to grow were, literally sitting next to my boss and watching her mark up pages and listening to her talk to people, talk to authors and talk to designers and talk to salespeople.
Wanted to add, when I was talking with the author of House of Dreams,
yes.
I think that's her editor, but she was
that's
raving
right.
about, yeah, she was just raving about her and how, you know, she'll think she'll create a first draft or something that's not as great, and then it'll, you know, get some magic from Liz Bicknell. Is that her name?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, that's just so interesting that happens to be kind of your mentor.
Yes, I mean, she's truly a remarkable editor and has been a wonderful person to kind of come up with at the company. And so now in my current role, sort of what I'm doing, what my list looks like these days is a number of my own authors and illustrators that I am working with and creating books with. And then I also work on a couple of imprints that we have at Candlewick. So we work with a publishing colleague in the UK. It's Templar Books is their overarching umbrella, and then I work specifically on a project called Big Picture Press, which are generally very design-led, often nonfiction books, particularly maybe some that maybe your listeners will have heard of is the Maps book, which came out a couple of years ago and is like a large format book of maps that became very popular. So those sorts of high design books come through that imprint. So I work on those, and I also work on Candlewick Studio projects, which are not dissimilar, but sort of books for all ages, books for book lovers. It's an imprint that's really celebrating the book as a physical artifact.
That's great. Well, before I dive into a little bit more about your role, I'm curious, for people who probably have been reading a lot of Candlewick books without just realizing it,
sure.
I know I mentioned a few, but could you talk a little bit about some of the Candlewick titles that people would probably be familiar with?
Sure. Katie Camillo is, as you mentioned, you know, she's really one of our stars. Most recently, kind of, I have this to talk about a little bit later, but most recently, we're looking forward to the publication of Louisiana's Way Home, which is follow up to Rheamy Nightingales.
I went to go see her speak about the new book at the Boston Book Festival, and she was just phenomenal.
Excellent.
It was magic. But yes, Katie Camillo, I'm sure readers are familiar with, and I know that and if they're not, they should go out and get her books. She read a little bit of Because of Winn-Dixie, which I would say would be a great place to start, and that was, I think I teared up a little bit watching her do
that. That's great.
But yeah, I know that's a big one for sure.
Absolutely. Meg Medina, whose upcoming book I'll talk about in maybe a little bit later, but Yaki Delgado Wants to Kick Your Ass, you know, received a ton of accolades. John Klassen, who has most recently his Shapes trilogy, but also, of course, all of his Hat books and his other work with Mac Barnett. Those are some books that we really, often turn to when we're talking about our cornerstones.
Yeah, those are some of my favorites. Whenever I've done, I'm a school librarian. I'm staying home this year with my daughter. But in the past, when I've done Mott Caldicott and things, all of his partnerships with Mac Barnett, those have always been like the kids' favorites. Those and some of mine
great.
Too, like The Wolf, the Duck, and the Mouse. I love that one. Those are great. So I guess one thing that I think listeners would be really interested in, I know for me, before I became a little bit more familiar with publishing, I think I had this vision of an editor just, you know, sits in a room all day by themselves looking at books. And I worked at Scholastic for a little bit right out of college in their production department, so I got a little bit of a taste of this, kind of routing things to different editors. But could you kind of give a sense of what a typical day is really like for you as an editor?
Sure. Yeah, it's a lot of communicating.
Yeah.
I think that that idea of an editor being alone in the room, like with a mug of tea and a pen, is kind of it's the ideal, but maybe it happens much more infrequently than any of us would perhaps like.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing that happens when I get in the morning is I check my email. Because we have partners in the UK, they get a jump start on the day. So it's great to get in as early as possible to see what concerns have come up for them overnight. And we address those issues. They can be publishing partners who have questions about projects that we're in process on. So if, you know, we need to make design changes, or they need to confirm some text changes that we've made, that's kind of the time that I get those concerns underway. There are always emails from agents with submissions. Those come in every day, and those get filed until I have my designated day to look through my submissions. And then there's a lot of meetings. It's meeting with primarily designers to go over whatever the latest set of pages are on any given project. I think that one thing that could that is maybe surprising or maybe makes complete sense based on what the medium is that we work in, we are not a very digital office. We have stacks of paper that we walk around the office and put in boxes and look up and mark up with pens, and it's called foul, and it very occasionally it goes missing because it will get clipped to the foul of another book, and then there's, you know, a low-level panic throughout the office as we all go to search for it. So there's
That's
a lot
interesting.
Of...
I was curious if that was still that way, because it was 10 years ago now that I was working at Scholastic, and I was just in like the little reprint section where with the books that were going in the little flyer. So it was not glamorous, but it was that, you know, just walking things around, and that would be my kind of sneak peek, getting to just like put something on an editor's, you know, in their inbox or something. But I was curious if that had changed. So that's interesting that it, I guess, especially for picture books and things, you need to be seeing it in print.
Yeah.
That would be really hard to do on the computer, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly can't speak to how other houses do it, and I think the process is slightly tweaked. There are a couple editors who work out of house, and they may have slightly more digital processes in that they aren't walking things around, but they are getting scans of the physical object that exists here in the office. Yeah, it is. It's very paper-based. So there are a lot of meetings where I'm sitting with a designer or a designer and an art director, and we are reading the picture book out loud, massaging text, pointing out, trying to find inconsistencies between the text and the art, and making decisions about how we'll rectify anything that's kind of not completely singing. And then there's a lot of looking at passes from, you know, copy editors and proofreaders and stuff like that too.
Well, you mentioned that you have a day where you look at your submissions, and that was another question I had for you, sort of what the process is at the very beginning when you're choosing what books you want to acquire and how you even go about that. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, absolutely. I think, I mean, not everyone has a day. Everyone kind of manages their submissions in their own particular way. I do best if I kind of set it all aside until I'm ready to tackle them kind of en masse. But generally, my list is made up primarily of new projects from people that I already work with, and then there is a certain percentage of new folks, so projects from folks with whom I have not yet worked. Those projects almost always come to me through agents, though they can occasionally come during a period. We have a period of open submissions that are tied to editors attending conferences, most specifically SCBWI. If an editor presents there, they'll often open their submissions for a finite amount of time to participants who have attended that conference. So some of my books have come to me that way, either through my own attendance at those conferences or my colleagues who have attended those conferences got a project that they thought was promising, but they just didn't feel like they were the right editor for it, and they passed it to me. So what happens is, basically, it's a very shallow editorial acquisition process at Candlewick. We don't have a editorial board. I share projects that I like with my boss, and then with members of the design staff, and then we all kind of talk about it, talk about viability and how we see it becoming a book, and then you know, that's how books get signed up for me.
And do you typically have to like bid on them, or how does that process work?
Sometimes books go to auction. It's an interesting question, like what percentage of books go to auction. I wouldn't say it's more than a quarter of the projects that I bid on go to auction.
Well, that's interesting.
And that's probably not true for everyone. I mean, that could just be a function of how much, like, you know, a function of the way my list is made up.
Well, Well, at that point in the process, it's just making me think what an exciting phone call that must be, or maybe it goes through the agent, but to be letting this author or illustrator know that this project they've maybe been working on for years is finally going to be published. I would imagine that would be a really exciting part of the process.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, they get that news directly from their agent generally. We're pretty siloed off from our creators when we're in the bidding process, even if it's someone that we've worked with before. We generally do all the business with an agent. If there is one, if there isn't one, we you know, kind of work through it directly with the creator. But the first call to after all the business is done, when we get to call someone and just, it's amazing. I mean, it's a moment when everything is possible. It's really great.
That's so exciting. Well, I know Candlewick does, and you were mentioning a mixture, you know, between picture books, middle grade, YA. Is what you're drawn to really different depending on that type? Like, is there a certain kind of picture book you're drawn to versus middle grade?
Yeah, I think that my kind of heart's true home in the publishing world is in the picture book sphere. But I definitely have a thread running throughout all of my projects, and it is a strong emotional center. So it can be YA, it can be middle grade, it can be easy readers, or it can be picture books. But there is kind of a strong emotional core that is very true. It doesn't have to be serious. It doesn't have to be anything. It just has to feel very authentic to kind of the emotional experience of a child.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would bring me to one of my other questions. I'm sure people would be curious about some of the books you've worked on and maybe some of your favorites that you've been involved with.
Yeah, absolutely. Most recently, or some of the titles that I've worked on most recently that I've loved working on are Rescue and Jessica, A Life-Changing Friendship, mm-hmm. by Jessica Kinski and Patrick Downs and Scott Magoon. It was an awesome experience.
Loved that one. I would definitely recommend that one as well.
Oh, that's great to hear. It was just an awesome process. Jessica and Pat and Scott are all really phenomenal people and really wonderful to work with. And the art director on that book, Ann Stott, is an incredible talent. And Allison Cole, an assistant editor, helped editorially throughout that process, which was phenomenal. I mean, we just had really great people who had a lot of passion for the project, doing everything they can to make it work. And everyone here was just so supportive, and it was great to be a part of that next phase for Jessica and Patrick. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
I worked on Julianne is a Mermaid by Jessica Love, which was also another really phenomenal process. Also again with Ann Stott, and that book was great because it kind of took all of us by surprise. I mean, when I started working on it, I knew I loved it. I loved it in what felt like a very personal way. And the closer we got to publication, the more people heard about it. It became clear that it was going to be resonant for many, many people for a mm-hmm. whole variety of reasons. And
for
that was
sure.
really awesome to see. And it was awesome to see because it felt so organic. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of things that happen with books is, you know, like our marketing team will come up with these awesome marketing plans and they'll execute, and you can just see how they are hustling and getting books kind of to the forefront of people's minds. Julianne was really interesting because the book just like took on a life of its own, and we kind of, you know, are following behind it with our mouths open, just so happy that everyone is receiving it kind of so positively. So that's been wonderful.
Yeah, that must be so gratifying. And I know I was going to ask too, sort of some of the highlights of your job, and I'm guessing something like that where it does just take off and have a life of its own must be really exciting, especially when you've seen it from the earliest stages. Are there other parts that you that are your favorite parts of the process or about or favorite parts of your job?
Yeah, I mean, the best part of this job generally are the people that I work with, the folks who work at Candlewick, the authors and illustrators that we work with, the librarians that we, meet with and have ongoing conversations with at conferences, our booksellers, the independent booksellers in the area who are just so ferociously, I mean, not just in the area, throughout the country, who are so ferociously behind our books and are such champions of books. I mean, it's a group of people who care very, very much about something that, I mean, I say this all the time, like the stakes working in children's books, they're low. We don't have to do brain surgery every day. There's no nuclear code. And it's a very long process. So there's a lot of opportunity to create or to fix your mistakes, and there's a lot of opportunity to improve and to be better. But in the end, you're making a product for a population whose memories are so good and are so subject to influence. So it's just a group of people who work in children's book who really want to do the right thing and are constantly, I think, challenging themselves to be better.
I think that's
a great group of people to be surrounded with every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally see that from the elementary library side, just that whole idea these are the books that are going to shape kids in some ways, and if you can find the right book that, we think so much about windows and mirrors and books, and like if you could find that book that's going to connect with somebody or, show them a totally different world or open their minds or their empathy a little bit, I think, it's so powerful, and to just spark their imagination. I mean, that's one of the things I love. I just think it's, there's something really special about that time in your life when you're reading children's books. And some of us never stop reading them, so that's
absolutely. I really think that sort of that thing you were just saying. I mean, the idea of being seen in a picture book if you have never seen yourself represented anywhere before is something that I think until you've had the experience of not seeing yourself, it's kind of hard to imagine how powerful it is. But like with Rescue and Jessica, not long after that book published, Jessica and Patrick got, I think, an email from, I'm pretty sure, a young boys librarian who, through a series of pretty unbelievable circumstances, this boy had then become a bilateral amputee, just like Jessica. So he was recovering. He was sort of learning to live in this new world, basically, and it was that was happening to him right around the time that Rescue and Jessica came out. So his like the people who loved him in his life were able to show him this book, where he could see someone who was living a life successfully that reflected his new reality. And I think that as a child reader, that's very powerful. But I also think as someone who loves a child who's in a very unique circumstance, it's like the one thing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes
I think that's so powerful, and I think it's great as an editor, you're helping those books come into being, and then librarians and teachers and parents, then we're trying to connect kids with those books, and I just think that's so powerful. And sort of leads me to one of my other questions, which is going to be some of the trends you're seeing in children's publishing. And I think one that I'm most excited about that I really feel like in the past 10 years has there's been so much progress with is the whole We Need Diverse Books movement.
Absolutely.
From when I was at Scholastic 10 years ago till now, I feel like there's been, we still have a long way to go, but I feel like there's been a lot of progress.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that is the thing. I mean, We Need Diverse Books and the subsequent movements around that, Own Voices and things like that, that has revolutionized our industry absolutely for the better. And there is no going back from this point that we're at, and that's fantastic.
And are
I mean,
you
I think
seeing
that,
– oh, sorry, go on.
No, sorry. I just think like that is the thing that I'm most excited about. I think it speaks to that nature of continuous improvement that I was talking about. There, mm-hmm. as you said, there is absolutely more work to do. There is, there will probably always be more work to do. But I think that that challenge can feel really exciting if you embrace that I as an editor, there are always ways that I can be better at this job and speak to more people in better ways, and make more children feel like their reality is reflected in the books that we make.
Yeah, I think that's so important. It's one of the things I'm most passionate about as a librarian too. And I'm just curious, from the very front end of the process, if you feel like you're seeing even more submissions from agents. I know you're saying a lot of this is coming through agents.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like at the front end as an editor, you're even getting a much more diverse set of choices in terms of submissions?
I think I'm getting more. I'd always love to see more. I think I can't get too many, really. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think, I mean, since when I started acquiring, probably, 7 to 10 years ago, yeah, I would say there are more, and diverse in a lot of different ways. I have this one project that's actually coming up in the spring, so it's a little bit too early to be talking about, but, it's by an author that I had worked with before, but she's chosen to tell a story that's much more personal to her. She grew up in Iran, and it is about her relationship with her grandmother, who was a devout Muslim, and it's, that's a book I worked with her for years. This isn't a story she's told. So I don't know what happened in the universe that the stars aligned that we're working on this book now, but, this is a book that we now have, and I'm so thrilled that we are going to be telling it, publishing it for a wide audience.
Yeah, that sounds great. So, that leads me to what I was also hoping to hear, forthcoming books that you're excited about on your list, but any others too that you're excited about that people could maybe add to their TBR list?
Absolutely. So my colleague Hillary has a book called We Are Here to Stay, and it is a photo essay by Susan Coughlin, who your listeners may remember from the Stonewall Honor winning Beyond Magenta. But this is the stories of 9 undocumented young adults who are living in America. And, the nature of children's book publishing is that everything takes really quite a long time to go from idea to published book. And there were a lot of massive changes in American policy and climate surrounding undocumented human beings who live in America in the making of this book. And so Susan and Hillary and their designer and kind of all of the staff here really had to examine this book over and over to make sure that we were doing kind of absolutely the right thing when it came to publishing it. But it's a gorgeous series of stories about courage and, how challenging it is to be a young person in America where your future is so uncertain and it's the only home that you've known. There is a new Meg Medina that I'm thrilled about, which is called Mercy Suarez Changes Gears, and it is a middle grade story about this protagonist named Mercy who is navigating changes at school and at home. It's really funny and just a completely resonant portrait of this girl's inner life and how she's reckoning all of these changes that are happening for her. Meg Medina is just a really wonderful human being, and we're so proud to publish her. And I think that her voice in the middle grade arena is like strong and fantastic and just truly wonderful.
I keep seeing that one. I need to push that up further on my to be read list, because I keep seeing it, and it does just sound so interesting, and I feel like it's one that I would really enjoy and like to pass on.
It's really good.
Oh, awesome. All right. So now I've got to add it to the top of the list.
Top of the pile.
Yes.
There's there's a picture book called The Patchwork Bike by Maxine Benabe Clark and Van Than Rudd. Maxine is a Australian writer and slam poet champion. And Van is a Australian street artist and activist, and it is it's a book that we, they are both Australian. It came to us from Australia, but at the most basic level, it's about making a bike from found objects, but it's equally about the power of exuberance and claiming kind of the joy in your life, even when it may seem like joy might be hard to come by. It's just the poetic nature of the text, the art, like it's really just a fantastic, it's really a fantastic picture book, and I'm really excited that we have it on the list.
Yeah. Any others you want to share?
Oh, God, I have like a billion.
Great. You never have too many to add to the list, so that's great.
Marion Dane Bauer and Aqua Holmes have a picture book out now out now, September. It's always very hard to know exactly where you are and like what is available and what is not available. So it is a book that is equally about the birth of the cosmos and the birth of a child. And the text is incredibly poetic and enchanting, and the illustrations are just truly awesome on this handmade marble paper. Aqua consistently surprises us and astounds us in absolutely the best way, which is just a wonderful quality.
I love her illustrations for that Wonder Poem Celebrating Poets book. I'm like, wow, I know that name. I'm sure I've seen others too. Yeah, I would definitely have to check that out.
It's a little different than that. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I will say if people are listening and wanting to add to their list, I will make sure to link to all of the ones we talk about.
Great.
For sure. Do you have any young adult that you're looking forward to that are coming out?
Absolutely. There is The Assassination of Brangwyne Spurge, which is M.T. Anderson and Eugene Yelchin's very deeply, truly submersive novel about warring kingdoms. It was actually just named to the shortlist of the National Book Award, which has been a cause for much celebration here. But it's a novel that's partially told through the illustrations, partially told through the text, but ultimately those two elements work together to share really powerful truths about how maybe the real victor in any battle is the one who's able to write the history of it.
That sounds great.
It's really great.
Well, you know, you're so immersed in the children's book world and, you know, always working with writers. I'm curious what advice you would give aspiring children's book writers.
Yeah, I don't have terribly innovative advice in the area, but I think the advice that people probably are getting a lot is really good advice. I think that the first thing you do is read a lot, and I would recommend going to talk to your local public librarian in the children's room and asking her what she thinks good books are that one should be reading if they're interested in making a go of it.
Mm-hmm.
The point of which is, of course, not to copy anyone's voice or do the same thing, but just to see what books are being made for children. I think that one thing that often surprises people is the kind of material that is presented to children. You know, I think that if you have a great respect for the child, you realize that actually kids can handle a lot, and books can be complicated or fraught or interesting in a way that maybe not everyone realizes children's books can be. So I recommend going and asking an expert what books are just unputdownable from their point of view. I also recommend looking into joining at least SCBWI, which is the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, which is a huge organization that's all over the world, actually, and is full of really great resources on how one gets started or keeps going in children's books.
That's great, and I love the advice about going and asking your librarian. Any I will just say, any librarians, you go and ask for some favorite children's book recommendations, we'll be thrilled to hand you a giant stack. So that's wonderful. I think that's really great advice.
One thing I learned in this job was that truly librarians are the world superheroes. I mean, they can do absolutely anything. If you ever need help, you should always find a librarian.
Yeah, and I think people are sometimes nervous to ask librarians for help, and you know, just know you're making their day if you ask them for book suggestions. So that's great. Well, I know you're constantly reading for your job, but I always like to ask guests just what they've been reading lately, and this could be something that you're working on or something that you're reading like just for fun, kid book, adult
book,
anything. But is there anything you've been reading lately you'd want to recommend to listeners?
Oh, so many. This is like my favorite thing to talk about.
Mine too.
I really try. I try to read a lot of adult books, as we might call them, in my off hours, because I don't, you know, I don't want my love of reading to get subsumed by my job. That is kind of an occupational hazard. When books are your job, you don't, it's nice to make sure you always are, you know, kind of doing things for you too. So I have some adult books that I would definitely recommend. I loved An American Marriage by Tayeri Jones.
Yeah, me too. Did you get to see her at the Boston Book Festival?
I didn't.
I didn't get over there either, but I bet it was good.
I bet it was so good. I also really loved Sex Object by Jessica Valenti, which came out a couple of years ago, but I have only come to recently.
Mm-hmm.
And I really loved, I'm recommending it to everyone these days. And Worsan Shire's poetry, which her book was called Teaching My Mother to Give Birth, I believe. But she was kind of came to real prominence. I mean, her poetry is just, it's unbelievable. It's so good. But her poetry is also featured in Beyoncé's Lemonade. So if you've seen the Lemonade video, you've seen some of her poetry. And I'm they're so good. And I'm definitely excited about a couple of books that are on my, they're on hold for me at the library. I'm just waiting my turn dutifully. I'm really excited about All You Can Ever Know by Nicole Chung, which is her memoir. And There Will Be No Miracles Here by Casey Gerard.
Oh, great.
I'm sorry. It's Casey Gerald.
It is always nice when you know you have some good holds in the queue coming up.
Oh, I love that. I love the queue.
Yeah. Yep. Except when they all come in at once, which was my problem the other day. I went and picked up like 12 of them. And
oh, man.
That is a little tricky, but it is great. Well, Katie Cunningham, I'm so glad I got to speak with you, and I'm sure listeners are really going to enjoy having gotten kind of an inside scoop on your work as an editor. That's great.
Yes, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure to speak with you, and I hope that we're in touch soon.
For links to all of the books mentioned on this episode, you can head over to the show notes at abookishhome.com. To learn more about Candlewick and stay in the know about forthcoming titles, you can visit candlewick.com and follow them on social media at Candlewick. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with a friend and be sure to subscribe. If you could also take a moment to rate and review A Bookish Home on iTunes to help people find the show, I would be so grateful. It would really be a big help. Are you reading a book mentioned on the blog or the podcast? I'd love to hear. Tag me on Twitter or Instagram at A Bookish Home. Thanks for listening and happy reading.